Welcome to the first lecture of this course. This course is rather different from the other courses I've given for the Mises Academy in that the other courses were centered on a particular topic, such as a particular subject, such as ethics or political philosophy, economics, history of economics. But here, what I'm going to do is concentrate on the work of just one particular thinker in all these fields. So what we're going to be doing, a little of everything. And what I want to do also, which is different from other courses, that I'm not just interested in the ideas that Rothbard had in this course. I'm going to give you some of his personal background and history. Some of this will be based on my own friendship with him. I knew Rothbard for 17 years. Anyone who could put up with me for that long a time must be a very special person. But so what I'm hoping to do in this course is, for those of you who haven't studied Rothbard or haven't studied him that much, I want to give you a general sense of what Rothbard was like and his views on some of the major topics he was concerned with. So if you get through this course and I get through it, give all my lectures, and you'll have, I hope, a good sense of what Rothbard's views were and what he was like, and this will equip you for further study of Rothbard. Now, for those of you who haven't taken any of my courses before or for courses from the Mises Academy, I just want to say a little bit about how the course is structured. I lecture for about an hour, and then there's a half hour in which we can have questions or discussion, and during the lecture you can type in comments in the chat box. I don't always answer them at the time, but we'll deal with them later if I don't. And then for those of you who are taking the course for credit, I have a weekly quiz, which is 10 multiple choice questions or multiple guess questions, whichever you prefer. And I'm not trying to trick anyone on these questions. I try to make the quizzes easy. It's just so people can get a general sense of how they know the top main topics covered in the lecture. As my greatest teacher, Walter Starkey, used to say, give all A's and B's, that way you build up a following. So that's what I try to do in these quizzes. I make them easy. Let's see if this works. Oh, good, the slide worked. Now, I want to say a little bit to begin with about Murray Rothbard's early life. Rothbard was born in 1926, on March 2nd, 1926, in New York. It's very important, one fact about him is very important because it's basic to the type of person he was, that you have to know he was from a Jewish family, but the family wasn't observant. So Rothbard was an atheist in his personal life, although he was not hostile to religion. In fact, he was sympathetic to the Catholic Church as a historical force and for its role in promoting scholastic philosophy and art, but he wasn't a personally religious person. That attitude, he rather took after his father, who had rejected religion from an early age. Now, the father actually come to the United States from Poland in 1910. Father's name was David Rothbard. And it turns out that the town in Poland he came from, the small community, was the same community that the famous Yiddish writer Isaac Bashevis Singer had come from. They were from the same area. So Rothbard's father had rejected religion from a very early age. What happened was the father was in a Hebrew school. And they were studying from the Bible, and they'd gotten to an episode. Of course, they're doing this in the Hebrew, but you remember in the English Bible, you'll find this in Genesis, I think, chapter 34, in which talking about Dinah, who was one of the daughter of Jacob, one of the three patriarchs, and there was a prince named Shechem who was from the Hivites. What a name, the Hivites, who really really liked Dinah. So what did he do? He raped her. So then the father of this fellow came to see Jacob and said, oh, well, you know, this is too bad this has happened, but, you know, now that it's happened, why don't why don't they get married, and then our two tribes can, your family can get together with our tribe, and we can all be one happy group now. So Dinah's brother, Judah, and another brother said, well, this gives us a chance. We'll tell them if we agree to this, then you have to agree to be circumcised. So, you know, that didn't sound like much fun, but they said, okay, they'll do it. And then on the third day after the circumcision, you know, they're all lying there in pain, so Judah and the brother came in and murdered them all. And they said, this is revenge for what they did to Dinah. So Rothbard's father thought that was kind of a sneaky thing to do, and according to Murray Rothbard, that turned him away from Judaism. And actually, it's funny, although the incident is reported, there's no indication that that's approved of. It's just reported. And later on, when Jacob is dying, he reproaches Judah and the other brother for doing this. He says, you shouldn't have done this. You were too hasty. But regardless of whether it's approved, that was what turned the father away from religion. And his son, Murray Rothbard, followed in his father's footsteps. Now, key factor to understand, again, Rothbard's early life is that in the community he grew up, this kind of a Jewish community in New York in the 1920s and 30s, there were a great many people who were pro-communist. You know, you think now probably most of us have never met anyone who was really a communist in the sense of someone who supports Soviet Russia. And we think now, well, you know, Stalin was one of the all-time great evil people, so how could anybody really support him? But at the time in the 1930s, there were a lot of people who did support him. And Rothbard remembers it in the time of the Spanish Civil War, which, remember, can anybody tell me, when did the Spanish Civil War begin? Does anybody know that? Or at least this Spanish Civil War. There were other Spanish Civil Wars, like in the 19th century. No Googling. 1936. Yes, that's right. It lasted 1936 through 39. And a lot of the people in New York were very concerned with this and very much on the side of the government. The government was kind of a pro-communist government, and there was a revolt against by Spanish generals. Eventually, Francisco Franco assumed the leadership of the nationalist forces against the Republican government, but although he wasn't the sole commander at the start, but the people in New York were very, very much against this nationalist revolt. They said, oh, this is the fascists who are revolting against the Republican government, so everybody should support them. The government and the Soviets gave aid to the Republican government, and the Nazi Germany and Italy under Mussolini gave aid to the nationalists. Of course, the nationalists were successful, and they took over in 1939. But Rothbard used to say, well, when he was just about 10 years old, he remembered asking at dinner, you know, what's so bad about the Spanish nationalists? Why should we care about this? And people were looking at him, what's wrong with this fellow? But from a very early age, he was someone who wasn't afraid to disagree with what the prevailing view was. Now, although there was a very much a pro-communist tinge to the community that Rothbard grew up with, and he had uncles, I think, and aunts who were in the Communist Party. His immediate family, his father and mother, were not pro-communist, and in fact, his father was influenced by the anarchists, not the communists. It wasn't particularly a left-wing variety of anarchism either. Of course, you know, there are left-wing anarchists, but Rothbard's father had fought with a labor union. The father was an industrial chemist, and at one occasion he'd been involved in a big fight with a labor union. So Rothbard, again, from an early age, was inclined to be very sympathetic to the free market and capitalism. He wasn't pro-communist, but he had a lot of pro-communists around him. And this is, I think, a very important fact to understand in his early thought, that he was concerned. He viewed himself, again, from this very young age, as someone who was combating prevailing leftist views. And I mentioned before, the father came from the same town as Isaac Bashevis Singer. Now, the family, you know, a lot of people, we think of the 1930s at the time, Depression, a lot of people were poor, but Rothbard's family wasn't poor. They were relatively well off. And Rothbard attended a private school. I think he'd first gone to public school for a while, but that didn't work out very well. And he attended a small private school that's still in existence. I think it's called the Birch Wathen School. And he did very well there. He was extremely bright. He did very well in all the subjects. So that was where he had his early schooling. Now, one of the most formative influences on Rothbard's views and thought was his stay at Columbia University. He was a student there during World War II, and he graduated in 1945, and then he got an MA the next year in 1946. Now, he passed his PhD orals in 1948, which is fairly fast, but he didn't finish his PhD till 1956, and a little later we'll get into the reason for that. So while he was at Columbia, he was influenced by a number of the professors, and one of the most important of these was Ernest Nagel, who was a professor in the philosophy department. Nagel wasn't a logical positivist. Remember the Vienna Circle of logical positivists in the 30s who were Mises very strongly criticizing human action. Now, Nagel wasn't a logical positivist, but his views were somewhat sympathetic to theirs. And in fact, later on, Nagel was a critic of Friedrich Hayek. He wrote an essay, you can find this essay reprinted in a book of Nagel's essays called Sovereign Reason, where he's very critical of Hayek on the method of the social sciences, where Hayek was saying, well, we've got to have this in economics and the other social sciences, we have this special method of understanding that's different from the laws in the physical sciences. And Nagel said, no, that's not right. We have the same method. I remember when I took a course from Hayek in 1969, I wrote a paper critical of Nagel, and Hayek was saying, oh yes, you must give us point-by-point refutation. He was very upset that Nagel had criticized him. But of course, that wasn't what Rothbard got from Nagel, wasn't the criticism of Hayek. I don't even know whether that came up. He did take a course with Nagel on philosophy of the social sciences. But what I would say was the most important thing he got, he was influenced by Nagel, was something else. Nagel was favorable to a view in philosophy of science called operationalism. Has anybody heard of operationalism? It has nothing to do with going in for surgery, but are people familiar with operationalism at all? Oh, no. People haven't. Well, then I could. Somebody has. So then I was going to say I can say whatever I want about it, but I guess I can't now. Okay. So what the operationalists were concerned with is that for scientific terms like length, in particular, say it was one example. This was one of the most famous ones. Well, we say, some physical quantity has a certain length, that's only a meaningful term if we can specify how the length is to be measured. So Percy Bridgman, who was a Nobel Prize winner in physics, who was one of the most important people supporting operationalism, would say, well, there are different ways scientists have a measuring length, so we really don't have a single concept of length. We have different concepts of length depending on the way we're measuring length. And as he said, this is a quotation from him, the meaning of a concept is a set of operations. So you can see this is related to the logical positivist who said that the meaning of a term is a proposition is the way we verify it. So here it's the meaning of a concept is a set of operations. And Rothbard had read Percy Bridgman, so he was very much aware from what he got from Nagel and from his own reading this view called operationalism. So maybe this sounds a little complicated, but the basic idea is simple, that a scientific concept is meaningless if you can't specify how it can be measured. So, say we're talking about gravity, we have to be able to specify how gravity is mentioned. If you just introduce some term and you don't have any way of saying how you can measure it, then according to this view, it isn't a properly formed scientific term. Now, for those of you who study Austrian economics, you'll see some parts of Austrian economics aren't consistent with operationalism. For example, utility is a very important concept in Austrian economics. If I say the utility of good is how I value a particular good, say, what is the utility of these lectures? Probably be, you'll see they're very low for most people. So, but that what we mean by utility is the value that something has for a particular person. But Austrians think utility can't be measured. So this wouldn't qualify as a scientific concept according to operationalism. So you might think, well, if Austrian economics isn't consistent with operationalism, so then Rothbard would really reject this view, because remember operationalism is saying scientific scientific concept has to be measurable, but some parts of Austrian economics aren't measurable. So you think, well, Rothbard's going to throw out operationalism. And he certainly accepted the parts of Austrian economics that weren't consistent with operationalism. He was very insistent utility can't be measured, for example. But he was nevertheless very influenced by this doctrine. I want to give just two examples. You see, what I'm doing in this lecture, I'm sure you realize this already, I'm giving kind of a mix of some arguments and details about Rothbard's life. In a lot of the lectures, there'll be more emphasis on particular views and doctrine, but this lecture I'm emphasizing a lot of stories about how Rothbard got to his views, so it's more. And also the last lecture, if I live that long, I'll give a lot of personal details also. But I want to give some arguments also, so it isn't all personal details. So one idea that's very important for Rothbard, what he called demonstrated preference. Let's take an example. Suppose somebody says, well, my neighbor is building a very horrible display in his yard. He's saying, building a life-size statue of Hitler made out of chopped liver. This is really making me feel bad, so maybe I should be able to prevent him from doing that because it's making me feel bad. So supposing you were trying to say, does it in economics, does that person's welfare go down because he doesn't like the statue made by out of chopped liver, statue of Hitler made out of chopped liver? Well, according to Rothbard, you really couldn't count that because the person hasn't done anything. He hasn't, say, gone over and knocked the statue down or anything. He's just maybe has some feeling of disliking the statue. So that doesn't count for Rothbard. The preference has to be demonstrated in action. And we can see this is really reflects an operationalist influence, because what Rothbard is saying is, look, we can't specify, unless there's some action, we can't really specify how we know the person has the preference. I mean, if somebody does something, we can see he has a preference, but if we're just trying to guess what's in his mind, then we really don't have a scientific concept of preference. So as I say, I think this is one example of how an operationalist doctrine influenced Rothbard. Now another is that you'll find in chapter 10 of Man, Economy, and State, he doesn't accept, Rothbard rejects the concept of monopoly price on the free market, because he says you can't specify how you could show that a particular price is a monopoly price. He said economists who favor this notion say, well, the monopoly price is above the competitive price, but why shouldn't we say instead the monopoly price is really the competitive price, and what the economists call the competitive price is really sub-competitive price? So again, he's saying, well, you're talking about monopoly price, but you have to specify, if it's a proper concept in economics, you have to specify how it we know that something is a monopoly price. How can you determine it? How can you measure it and find out it is a monopoly price? So I think this reflects this operationalist influence. So I say that's, I think he got that, at least to some extent, to a large extent, from Ernest Nagel. Now, another economist, professor who influenced Rothbard was Arthur Burns. I see a question here. Malcolm asked, did he come to these conclusions based on a steady interest in set theory? Well, that's a very good question. Rothbard studied set theory, was very interested in set theory, majored, I think, in one of his I think had a dual major in math and statistics when he was an undergraduate, but I don't think Sutter would directly have had any view on how scientific terms are to be determined. I mean, it could, I think it shows in Sutter he's very interested in kind of axiomatic developed systems, and this in part accounted for his attraction to Austrian economics as developed by Mises, but I don't think it would come in right there. Now, of course, Nagel was a philosopher, not an economist, but one of the strongest influences on Rothbard at Columbia was the economist Arthur Burns, who later became the head of the Council of Economic Advisers under President Eisenhower. And Burns lived in the same apartment building as Rothbard's family. A family friend. And there's a letter from Rothbard's father, David, where he asks Arthur Burns to look out for his son. I think Burns was hoping at one time that Rothbard would be his disciple. Burns tended to be very suspicious of economic theories. He had been a follower of Wesley Clair Mitchell, who was an American institutionalist economist, the founder of the National Bureau of Economic Research, or one of the main people in that, and what they believed was more in gathering data rather than coming up with economic theories. And Burns rejected the theories of Keynes, which were very influential at the time, but Burns rejected them. Although he was against theory, didn't like economic theories very much, he was very good at criticizing them. He was a good logician. He could really come up with what's wrong with economic theories. And you'll find in Man, Economy, and State, if you look at some of the footnotes, Rothbard will say, I got such a particular point, such and such particular point from classroom lectures by Arthur Burns. Now, one thing that reflects Burns' influence on Rothbard is we can see this in an early criticism of Keynes that Rothbard wrote in a magazine called Analysis, which is spelled with a small A, not a capital A, published by Frank Chodorow. And we'll talk about Frank Chodorow a little later. But Rothbard published this article in Chodorow's magazine. Actually, Chodorow was very reluctant to publish this because he thought it was too technical and too long for his magazine, but he finally did. So the type of criticism that Rothbard gave really of Keynes really reflected Burns' influence. This was before, when he published this, he didn't really know that much about Austrian economics. He knew a little bit about it. I shouldn't have said before this applies, he didn't know anything. I think he was aware of Austrian economics to some extent, but what he was really writing here was not so much an Austrian criticism of Keynes, but a type of criticism he got from Burns. So what Rothbard said in this article, and you can look at this in an anthology of Rothbard's unpublished papers called Strictly Confidential that I edited. So he said, the main variables in Keynes' system kept changing, couldn't be exactly measured. Remember, this is not the place to go into a real detailed account of what Keynes said, but remember, in Keynes' view, that total spending is determined by consumption plus investment. So if there's a falling off of investment, then the government is supposed to come in and increase spending, so you have, if it doesn't do that, then it'll cause unemployment. So what Rothbard said in this article is that, well, Keynes doesn't have an exact way of measuring consumption and investment. If you try to do that, you'll see that you don't get constants, they'll keep shifting. And so if you have some view, well, if you can increase one of them, you can come up with some laws about the total effect on on the economy, say just by increasing consumption spending or increasing investment spending, you won't be able to do it. So I see, again, we have kind of an operationalist criticism. You don't have exact ways of measuring or specifying these basic variables in Keynes's system, so therefore it isn't a properly scientific system. Now, I mentioned Ernst Nagel, who's not to be confused with Thomas Nagel, who's a different philosopher, very influential philosopher now at New York, who also is somewhat critical of Hayek. I guess people named Nagel tend to be, philosophers named Nagel tend to criticize Hayek. Although Thomas Nagel hasn't published Criticism of Hayek, but he's given that. He sometimes made critical remarks about him in his seminars. But I mentioned Ernest Nagel and Arthur Burns, but the most important teacher that he had in graduate school was neither of those, but Joseph Dorfman, who was an economic historian. That was the field in which Rothbard got his PhD, economic history. Now, Dorfman was a great historical scholar. He wasn't so much a theorist. He was a follower of Thorstein Veblen. He wasn't too much interested in economic theory. He was kind of more interested in what particular people had said about economics. But what his trademark was in sort of enormous use of historical sources. He read everything, and he would, if you go to his books, I think he has a big several volume called The Economic Mind in American Civilization, you can see he's read everything. And this is what Rothbard did. If you look at Rothbard's books, he had a tremendous ability to read very fast, and he would just get all the relevant sources on everything. So he got this really from Dorfman, this way of proceeding by kind of trying to look at everything or at everything possible. So he got from Dorfman not only this particular emphasis on historical scholarship, but he was influenced by a particular view that Dorfman held. Dorfman had been very critical of a book by Arthur Schlesinger. Schlesinger, you may know, is a historian at Harvard who wrote a book called The Age of Jackson. And Schlesinger was a very strong supporter of Franklin Roosevelt. He wrote a three-volume study praising Roosevelt. What Schlesinger said was that the Jacksonians, the followers of Andrew Jackson, were really precursors of the New Deal. So Dorfman said, no, that's not right at all. That's a very anachronistic view of them. They were, in fact, they believed in the free market. They weren't precursors of the New Deal. So Schlesinger was pitching this kind of radical Democrats, but Dorfman said, that's not true. And this Dorfman's view of the Jacksonians was adopted by Rothbard, and he was very influenced by this. Now, in particular, one view that Dorfman adopted when he was criticizing Schlesinger was, Schlesinger was saying, Jacksonians were opposed to the Bank of the United States. So generally, the people who oppose bankers tend to be very poor people. People who are in debt, and the ones who favor the banks are the rich people or the creditors. So Schlesinger said, well, look, since we know the Jacksonians were opposed to the banks, then we can identify them primarily as poor people. So just like the people who supported the New Deal were the poor, Franklin Roosevelt was always attacking the the economic plutocrats and these rich people. So the Jacksonians, according to Schlesinger, were similarly the poor people against the rich bankers and the creditors. So what Dorfman said, and this was something that Rothbard emphasized a lot, was that it's false to think that creditors are usually rich and debtors are poor, because a lot of rich people want to get even richer, and one way they do that is to borrow a lot of money. So there, you very often find people who are extremely rich who are in debt. So what this view that the debtors are always poor and the creditors rich isn't correct. Now, one, I mentioned we have to bring Arthur Burns back. Now, as I mentioned, Burns at one time wanted Rothbard to be his disciple, and he wasn't satisfied with the way Rothbard was doing his dissertation. That Rothbard was working on a dissertation on under Dorfman on the Panic of 1819, and as you would expect from a student of Dorfman, what he was doing was putting in a lot of historical material, going through all the pamphlet literature of the time, what people at the time had said about the crisis. And Burns said, no, what you need to do is concentrate more on the economic statistics. So he wouldn't accept Rothbard's dissertation. He kept insisting that he revise it. And Rothbard only got the PhD when Burns was away. As I said, he was working for Eisenhower, so he'd been on leave from Columbia, and that's why Rothbard's PhD degree was delayed until 1956. You know, he got past the orals in 1948, but he didn't get the degree until 56. Now, a question that I'm sure will be of very much interest in the course is, how did Rothbard first get to know about the free market? And the way this happened, I mean, he knew something about it from his family background, but the way he knew about it in economic theory was he took classes from George Stigler, who was that time was at Columbia. Stigler later went on to become one of the leading professors at the University of Chicago. He was one of the leading people in the so-called Chicago School. So Stigler had wrote a pamphlet together with Milton Friedman, who at that time was a promising younger economist. Now I see now your question here. Kevin wants to know, was Burns' view of economists gathering data connected anyway with the German historicists? Well, it's similar in a way, but I don't think he was directly influenced by them, but it is similar in a way. Burns was more influenced by Wesley Clair Mitchell and the American institutionalists. So Stigler and Friedman published a pamphlet called Roofs or Ceilings. Roofs, I should, not just one roof. And this was critical of rent control, you know, in New York City especially. Their controls on rent, and as a result, there was a housing shortage. So Stigler and Friedman criticized this, and Stigler criticized rent control in his lectures on price theory that Rothbard attended. So Rothbard was very interested in what Stigler was saying. Now, the pamphlet was published by an organization that's still around called the Foundation for Economic Education, which was headed by Leonard Reed. And Leonard Reed, incidentally, thought the pamphlet didn't go far enough, because what Stigler and Friedman said was something like, the people who favor rent control say, well, we want lower rents because we want to help the poor people. And then they said, well, rent control doesn't, in fact, help the people because it just makes housing more scarce for them. But Stigler and Friedman said, well, this idea of helping the poor, that there's too much inequality, is correct. We think that too. We just think the way these economists or others who want to interfere with the free market are going about reducing inequality is doesn't work. So they said, well, we favor equality too. We're just going about it the wrong way. And Reed wasn't having any of that. He said, no, we shouldn't believe in equality at all. You're really accepting the goal that you shouldn't. And Ayn Rand also held that view. She thought that this was kind of really selling out if they said that. But whether it was or not, the pamphlet did attract Rothbard to the free market theories and also to this group, the Foundation for Economic Education. And when he was at this fee, he met Frank Chodorov, the one who published his article on Keynes, and he also met another person who was working there, F.A. Harper, was nicknamed Baldy Harper, even though he wasn't bald. He was, for some reason, nicknamed Baldy. He had been a professor at Cornell University. Now, both Harper and Chodorov were anarchists. That's they believe, they're not anarchists in the sense people believe in chaos or people don't think we need any legal system. They thought we don't need a monopoly agency as the government of a territory. Even if it's a limited government, that was too much for them. They said, no, there should be competition even in protection and defense agency. So they didn't believe in government at all. Frank Chodorov, who was one, had a great deal of influence on Rothbard, was a disciple of Albert J. Nock, who was an early libertarian theorist and a considerable literary figure in the 1920s and 30s. 1940s. Chodorov accepted Nock's view of the state, which Nock in turn had taken from the German sociologist Franz Oppenheimer. And what, according to that theory, the state is predatory and exploitative. So it isn't that the state is really this great organization performing indispensable services for us. It's really a kind of a gang of thieves who's taking advantage of everybody else. So what Nock said, well, suppose you want to gain wealth, how can you do it? Well, one way is what he called the economic means. You can engage in production or exchange with other people, which all the parties to exchange benefit from it. But another way you could get wealth is just to take it away from people who produce things. So we call this the political means. So the state, on this view, isn't helping things out. It's just taking away from what other people are doing. It's like, imagine the mafia comes in and says, well, we'll protect you if you have to give us some of your businesses, you have to give us some of your profits. Of course, what it's protecting them from is attacks by them. So they're saying they're really extorting money from us, and we won't damage you if you give us money. So Nock and Chodorov said that's what the state is doing. And Rothbard accepted that view, and it's really very basic to his thought that he viewed the state. And he said, he was criticizing the libertarian writer David Friedman. He said, well, David Friedman, who's an anarchist theorist, doesn't hate the state. He said, really, it's essential to really hate the state. And incidentally, David Friedman said Rothbard was right on that he doesn't hate the state. So he didn't think that was a valid criticism, but he thought Rothbard was right to say that about him. Now, one area, though, where Chodorov and Nock didn't convert Rothbard to their view was that they were Georgists. That's the followers of Henry George, who thought that the community was really the owner of all the land in a given territory, so there shouldn't individual people who own land should really have to give all the rent from the land, the profit just from the land rather than the improvements they made, give it back to the community. So they're called the single tax movement. I see here's a question. Did Rothbard have any view about the protests in 1968? I think he was fairly sympathetic to them, at least certain aspects of those protests. But I have to check that to be sure, but I believe he was fairly sympathetic to them. Okay, so the thing that's, so I say the Georgists believe that the land is really owned by the community. There shouldn't individual people really operate, use the land, really should really be using it for the benefit of the community, and they would just be able to get to keep for themselves what the improvements they made on the land, and the pure rent would go to the government. Of course, now how, what Chodorov and Knott couldn't say go to the government because they didn't believe in the government. They would just say return to the community. And Rothbard didn't accept that. In fact, he became one of the leading critics of Henry George. He wrote several pamphlets attacking him. It was funny. Rothbard is one that the Georgists get very upset when they think about him, when they look at him. There was one very prominent economist, Harry Gunnison Brown, who'd been around since the early part of the 20th century. He was general of free market economists with strong Georgists, who was very angry that Rothbard had criticized Henry George. Now, Rothbard, while he was at Fee, learned that the great Austrian economist, Ludwig von Mises, was giving a seminar at NYU. Remember, Rothbard was enrolled as a grad student at Columbia, but he went to hear Mises' seminar. He went, started attending Mises' seminar around 1949. And this was also, 1949 was the year that Mises' great treatise, Human Action, was published. I remember, some of you were, I think, were in this course. I gave a course just the previous term from U Academy on part one of Human Action. This is an extremely important book, probably the greatest economic treatise of the 20th century. And Rothbard was extremely impressed by this book, especially the systematic character of the book. What Mises did, he made really an audacious claim. He said that you could deduce economic theory from the concept of action. And Rothbard was very much taken with this idea, and he developed that in his own work. This really, when he became interested in Mises, it was really a tremendous experience from this. You remember Paul Samuelson, as some of you know, when he said when he read Keynes' book, The General Theory, he thought of Wordsworth's line. Wordsworth wrote in the French Revolution, "Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven." So I think we could apply those lines to Rothbard when he read Human Action. He was really tremendously taken by this, by Mises' books and his view where economics could be developed on the concept of action. So around the same time, Rothbard arrived at a key element in his system of thought. After he met Frank Chodorov and Baldy Harper, he started to study the 19th century individualist anarchists, especially Lysander Spooner and Benjamin Tucker. And in particular, Spooner's argument against consent theories of government really impressed him. What Rothbard was impressed by was this. Suppose someone says, well, why do we have to support the government? Isn't it just telling us what to do? Why do we have to obey the government? So one very popular answer is, well, people have really consented to this. You know, if you look in Locke's Second Treatise on Government, this is the basis of his theory. So people will tell you, well, we live in a democracy here in America, so we don't have a government that's imposed on us, like, say, in Stalinist Russia. We really, it's the government that we choose. People have really consented to this government. Of course, you know, they're losers in the election. They wanted somebody else, but still, we've all agreed on this system where we're going to choose the government by election. So have we all consented to this? So Lysander Spooner said, no, this isn't right. He said, well, say, who really consented to the Constitution? He said, let's have a list of people who really approved of it. If we say certain people in the past did, why should that be binding on anybody now? So Spooner really kind of knocked out the standard arguments were given in favor of consent. So Rothbard agreed with Spooner. He said, well, this is right. You know, we really don't have any good basis for saying people approve of the government. But Spooner and Tucker hadn't known economic theory very well. In fact, they had rather odd views on economic theory. Especially Tucker, he thought, well, we just have to have banks issuing credit, and really we could just end interest, and we could just promote prosperity by having the government issue, by having the society, not the government, issue these free banks, mutual banks would issue a lot of money. You'll still find so-called left libertarians who were sympathetic to that view, but Rothbard accepted Mises. Austrian economists, of course, rejected that view. So what Rothbard did was he combined the anarchist views of Tucker and Spooner with Mises' Austrian economics. So that's really the Rothbardian synthesis, is that you combine individualist anarchism with Austrian economics. So against the limited state, which is favored by Leonard Reed and some others at Fee, Reed at one point seemed a little sympathetic to anarchism, but then he moved away from that. So Rothbard asked, well, what is the basis for this minimal state that you favor? The consent arguments for it just don't work. Now, after this, Leonard Reed moved away from anarchism. So some of the anarchists, such as Baldy Harper, left Fee, and after the Harper left and some of the others left, in Rothbard's view, Fee was no longer the intellectual center of the free market movement. There were still good people who wrote for them or were associated with them, but in Rothbard's view, that was no longer the center. I remember he told me once he described the Fee staff as the farm team, and that got them, particularly Leonard Reed, very upset when he heard that. So around the same time, in the early 1950s, there was a group called the William Volcker Fund, which was headed by a man named Howard Luno. It became the main funding source for free market ideas, and also they funded studies in revisionist history. Revisionist history was basically a history that questioned the American participation in World War I and World War II in favor of policy of non-intervention. So the Volcker Fund financed scholars who were interested in the free market and also revisionist historians. So it not only supported Rothbard, Mises, and Hayek, but also supported Milton Friedman, Ronald Coase. So almost all the free market economists became famous later and received support from the Volcker Fund. Rothbard worked for the Volcker Fund as a book reviewer, and what he would do was they would send him all sorts of books on economics, history, philosophy, political theory, pretty much everything. He'd give very detailed accounts of these books, usually showing he had knew more about the subject than the author did. You can look at some of his memos in that book I mentioned before that I edited called Strictly Confidential. And according to my friend who just passed away recently, George Resch, who was Baldy Harper's assistant and worked for Volcker Fund, supporting the Rothbard was one of the principal aims of the Volcker Fund. Oh, I see a question. What was the purpose and what was the audience for Rothbard's Volcker Fund book reviews? Well, it was mainly for the Volcker Fund people. They wanted to know which books to support. They distributed books. I think there was a group called the National Book Foundation, which would give out books, and so they wanted to know which ones to support. They were also interested in finding out which scholars they should support. So if Rothbard's views on particular authors would be very influential. Now, Baldy Harper founded a very important group, which is still around, called the IHS, Institute for Humane Studies, in 1961. And this he had support from the Volcker Fund. Now, you sometimes see Harper and with the assistance of George Resch was really the only founder of the of this group. You sometimes hear other accounts where other people are credited with being founders, but they're not. That isn't true. It was founded by Harper and with assistance from George Resch. Now, while Rothbard was working for Volcker, he got funding to write a textbook on Austrian economics based on human action. Of human action, if you read it, is a rather difficult work, especially the first section, the philosophy section, about the first 142 or so pages of the book is rather difficult. I gave a course in this last term. They always give me the tough ones to do. I don't know why, but I think maybe I can make them more confusing to people, so that's why they always assign me those topics. But a lot of people would find human action very difficult to read. So Rothbard's grant was supposed to be that he would write kind of a simplified textbook version of human action that would be useful to students. But it became, sometimes with Rothbard, a fairly short book of his plan became very much larger. And he wrote Mankind and State, which was his full-length treatise on economics, giving a lot of his own stuff, not just what he'd gotten from Mises. And so this is one of the most important books written in the 20th century by an Austrian economist. And you can take courses at Mises Academy just on this book. And he also wrote Power and Market, which was a development of his anarchist views as part of Man, Economy, and State, but that was taken out on the suggestion of another person who worked for Volcker named Frank Meyer, who was a friend of Rothbard. They got along very well, but Meyer thought, well, that should be published separately. Meyer was an interesting character. He'd been a member of the Communist Party and wrote a book called The Molding of Communists after he left the party. But he had abandoned the party. In fact, he wrote a fairly sympathetic review of Hayek's Road to Serfdom when it came out for the Communist Party publication Political Affairs. But anyway, he was the one who said that Power and Market should be published. It should not be in part of Man, Economy, and State. It was only published a number of years later. Okay, so I think I've gone on long enough. So now you can, we have the rest of the time, another half hour for questions and discussion. So you can put your questions either in the Q&A box or in the chat, whichever you prefer. Wait, let me just get it. Wait, I did something wrong here. Q&A. Wait. Okay. Yeah, I got both of them now. So you can do. Let me just see if any. So I think there were some comments in the chat here I wanted to look at here. I see. Well, there's some discussion of Rothbard in the New Left here. I don't think I'll get into that. Now, Leslie wants to know what part of New York did Rothbard live in. I think he was born in the Bronx, but then he later lived in Manhattan. Malcolm says, who was the first to use the term anarcho-capitalist? That I'd have to check. That's an interesting question. Malcolm says, I've said that I try to read one major book a month. Did I say it? No, I think what I said was I was making fun of this fellow Allison who said that he read a difficult book every month. I try to read a bit more than that. Rothbard would read an amazing amount. I don't know how many books he read a month, but you know, one used to go into bookstores with him and he would give comments on all the different books. But I don't think I said, I mean, if I read one book a month, 1,000 pages, I mean, that would be, I mean, that would practically be, I mean, I would only do that when I go further along to senility than I already am. I mean, that would not be very good at all. Now, someone said, how long was the Chodorov newsletter? I thought it was 8 pages. Yes, it was a very short publication. In fact, one reason Chodorov was reluctant to publish Rothbard's article on Keynes was he thought it was too long for his journal. Now, I have one here. Keynes spent some time discussing why you're more sympathetic to Rothbard's analysis of the state than by the work of other libertarians like Nozick. Well, Bob Nozick, you know, I knew him very well for about 20 years. And you see, he has very interesting arguments, which were principally directed against Rothbard in part one of Anarchy, State, and Utopia. A great book came out in 1974. I don't think he says there would be, what he says is if you start off with private protection agencies the way Rothbard wanted, you could have a series of steps in which you could get to a minimal state in which nobody's rights would be violated, but these steps would always be to people's advantage, so we'd form a minimal state. And I just don't think the particular steps of the argument work. I mean, one of them is he puts a lot of emphasis on what he calls risky decision procedures. So the agencies would prohibit other agencies from using risky decision procedures on their clients. I don't think he really shows why that would be particularly a significant development. Then also, supposing, according to Nozick, suppose two agencies just had some sort of procedure they follow. If, say, there's a conflict between them, they would follow some kind of appeals procedure, and they say, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to arbitrate the disputes and have some court that will settle what's to be done. He would count those agencies as part of a single group. So, say, if you have an arbitration agreement among all these agencies, then you have a state, and that seems like it wouldn't be really a state. So the system Rothbard favored would be one where the different agencies would have procedures on what to do in case there were conflicts. So He would have to call Rothbard's system a minimal state, but it would seem like an odd way of looking at it. Well, I should say, you know, I'm giving you a lot of, trying to give you some personal details on it. Rothbard and Nozick really didn't like each other at all. It was more Nozick didn't like Rothbard the other way around, although Rothbard certainly didn't like him. And since I knew both of them, that could sometimes get me into trouble. Now, what reason did Frank Meyer give for moving power and market in mankind? Well, I don't think he accepted kind of the anarchist views of the book, and he thought that would give it too much of a political tinge. He thought that he really liked the economic analysis, and he didn't want the, he thought the book would get mired in unnecessary controversy by including them. Now, here's one. Someone wants to know, who were the principal Austrian theorists after him? Who was the principal Austrian theorist? Well, I mean, there are a number of good Austrian economists, Joe Salerno, Guido Holtzmann, Hans Hopper, good ones. Are there Austrian centers of thought right now besides Mises? Well, I mean, there's sort of semi-Austrian work done in other places. I think, say, the Mises Institute, I think, is the main group. Is Murray Rothbard the most prodigious Austrian of all time? Well, he's certainly one of the greats, along with Mises, who is the second most prolific Austrian writer, maybe Walter Block, I don't know. How crazy is, were Spooner and Tucker the most significant influence on Rothbard becoming an anarchist? I'd say more it's his personal contact with Harper and Chodorov. I mean, he studied Spooner and Tucker, but I'd say it's more his personal contact with them, with those people. Malcolm says, why did Rothbard move to Nevada? Well, what happened was, he'd been teaching at Brooklyn Polytechnic, but he didn't get such a high salary there. He said, you know, he was very a famous person, said, he used to say, well, you would think maybe the Brooklyn Poly people would be glad to have it. But he said their attitude was, well, if you're so smart, why aren't we rich? Why aren't you bringing more money into the school? But then the Las Vegas University offered him an endowed chair, which was paying much more money. So he that's what why he decided to go over there. And he had some, first, I mean, there were people in the department who didn't like him much, and he had some memorable battles with them. But so then he stayed there through the rest of his life, and he would go back to. They had a he and his wife Joey Rothbard had a house there, but then they would go back to their apartment in Manhattan. Was Rothbard always a night owl? As long as I knew him, he was. I remember once, you say, I don't stay up very late, but there's one some discussion. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was very tired, and I went to bed, and I was going to bed. He said something like, yeah, the night is still young. Why are you leaving? I mean, there's some people who can work a tremendously long time. I had an email from a great friend of mine who's actually a student in this class who was telling me she was staying up 42 hours so she could complete some work. Now, Kevin said, can you elaborate on Tucker, who he was and what he wrote? Well, Tucker was one of the main individualist anarchists of the late 19th century. He lasted a fairly long time. I think he died around 1930. But he has he just had a newsletter, a magazine in which he published his views. They were he wasn't a supporter of natural rights, but he had his own version of individualist anarchism that a lot of people favored. I mean, I would recommend if you go to the Roderick Long website. He's a philosopher at Auburn University. He has a lot of material on Tucker, so that would be a good place. If you want to get more on him, you could find out. Let me see. Yes, that's so. Now, Christian says, and now the question is, would Rothbard be sympathetic to property destruction against the likes of AIG? I don't recall he wrote on this topic. I mean, he thought that, of course, there shouldn't be government subsidies to businesses, but I don't think he favored any kind of violence against them. His principal strategy was just to hope that people became acquainted with the libertarian ideas and tended to adopt them. But I mean, I can't see him as sympathetic with this Occupy Wall Street movement. Here's one. And to what extent his views were shaped by his family? Well, there, I think if you just go through the first few slides, that I tried to deal with that. Basically, he was influenced by his father much more than other people in his family. He rejected kind of the pro-communist atmosphere that was prevalent at the time in his community. Where someone recommends Justin Ray Mondo's Enemy State. Yes, that is a very good book. Justin was, Raimondo and Ray Rothbard were very close, particularly in their political, Justin was involved in all the political movements in the Libertarian Party. I'll be dealing with that very little bit in the Lecture 6, but that is a very good book to read. Charles asked it, MRNO RJ Rushdoony. Ah, now that's an interesting, he was aware of Rushdoony, didn't think much of him. I must say, I knew Rushdoony myself, but in the correspondence, he and Harry Elmer Barnes would refer to him as Rush Looney. And he, once reviewing, I think he reviewed for the Volcker Fund, one of Rushdoony's first book was called Intellectual Schizophrenia. And he said about it, it's rather charming to see the Catholic Church referred to as the Horror of Babylon. But Rushdoony was a very interesting person. I knew him in the 1960s. He was a very learned person. I remember he had a mellifluous voice, but he would say some rather odd things. I remember he said to me, Rushdoony said to me once, he had gotten from the Library of Congress a copy of the trial record of Joan of Arc. He'd been reading, and he said, she was a witch, all right. And then I said, but didn't the Catholic Church make her a saint? And he said, yes, but that was for political reasons. Now, Malcolm is a big deal on the fallout of MR with the Ayn Rand group. What was his final thing? Well, what had happened there, you see, he knew Rand, I mean, from the old days, And his first reaction to her was very critical. He thought she was dogmatic. And his George Reisman thought that she was very her system could lead to totalitarianism. But then when Atlas Shrugged came out, I think around 1957, Rothbard really was impressed by this book, and he wrote to Rand saying what a great novel it was. And for a while, his group, the Circle of Basquiat, would meet with Rand's group, but then they didn't get along. One thing was Rothbard would do, and his group were especially Ralph Raico and Ronald Hamway, had very strong sense of humor, and they did parodies of Rand, where they would make fun of Rand in her circle. And Rand found out about this, I think, through George Reisman. And then also, Rothbard wrote an essay called The Mantle. I think it appeared called The Mantle of Science. It appeared in a volume called Scientism and Values, where he mentioned an argument that's sometimes used against determinism, that determinism is inconsistent, or at least it's some sort of logical trouble, because if our thought, everything is determined, including our thought, then our thought determinism is true as determined. So Rand said, Rand, especially Nathaniel Brandon, said, oh, Rothbard had gotten this from Barbara Brandon's master's thesis, but he didn't cite her, so he plagiarized her. But he, of course, he didn't cite her, but I mean, the argument was very well known. I guess the Randians had thought they originated the argument. You know, I mean, it was extremely well known. One person who used it was actually Rand's great philosophical enemy, Immanuel Kant. And when Mises heard about this controversy, he was really amazed that anyone would think that this argument wasn't common knowledge. So that led to a big falling out. Now, someone's, you know, trying to, did Rothbard become an anarchist in 1946 or 1949? Well, it's hard to date it precisely. You know, you can see his discussion of betrayal of the right somewhere in those years. I would think more closer to 46 and 49. Now, did Rothbard Eric's his views on Kuhnelt Ledin? Yes, I knew Kuhnelt Ledin. You know, he's a very nice person. But I think at one time, the Rothbard group was rather critical of him. There was an essay, rather critical essay, by Ralph Raico that on Kuhnelt Ledin, I think, came out in Libertarian Forum. But then they became more friendlier to him later on. He was Kuhnelt Ledin was a very learned person. He was kind of somewhat libertarian. He was kind of a libertarian monarchist. Kuhnelt Ledin thought very highly of Hans Hoppe because of Hans's defense of monarchy. Yes, he was. Kuhnelt Ledin was. Yes, one could do a lecture on him. He was. He and Kuhnelt Ledin and Rushdoony were friends. People might not know that, but they knew each other. Someone has a beat up copy of Liberty and Equality. Oh, it's very expensive. Yes, I have an autographed copy of that book. I see then that Danny has something on Rushdoony. Yes, and he's referring to Luno there. Yes, except Volker's misspelled there. It's V-O-L-K-E-R, not C-K. Yeah, Gary North is Rush Duty Center. Yes, of course, they had a big falling out, Gary North and Rush Duty. I think it had to do with one of the issues was whether Rush Duty tends to favor the home church and Gary North didn't. Another difference was I think Gary North accepted the Copernican astronomy and Rush Duty didn't. Now, is Rothbard ever subject to the draft with the Korean War going on in the early 1950s? Well, at the time, I think he was would be more when draft would have been relevant to him would be more in the World War II period. I think he was just not accepted by the draft board. Now, there is one story that I heard from Ronald Hamaway that he was very good on at math, and he was offered the chance to work with the atomic energy project when they're developing the A-bomb, but he decided not to do. He didn't want to do that. But yeah, by the Korean War, he would have been, I think, over the age that they were taking people. Number he's born in 1926, so Korean War was 1950. Well, maybe not, but I don't think he was ever bothered by them. Someone said, did Rothbard offer a scholarship to Columbia, or did he pay it by himself? I don't know that. I know he made the Phi Beta Kappa at Columbia. He did extremely well, but I don't know that. Can you speak of MR's cultural view concerning social issues, whether he was a paleo-libertarian at one point? He was pretty conservative on social views. You know, he especially didn't like modern art. He liked a book by Hans Zettelmeyer, who was a great art historian, Austrian art historian, called The Lost Center, kind of criticism of modern art. And he joined with the paleo-libertarians around 1989, the last few years of his life, the paleo-conservatives. There was a conference at the Rockford Institute in late 1989. I was there and some other people. So Rothbard would not have been sympathetic at all with leftist cultural views, although when he allied with the left, it was principally, in those periods, it was principally like their anti-war views. Some question here. Is Ralph Rako still around? Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, he's not in such good health now, but he's still around. He still follows things and has good comments on them from time to time. Now, another question here. Did he ever vote at all? I don't think he did. He was one time he wrote speeches for a New York congressman named Ralph Gwynn, but I don't think so. So someone says he had a good review of the piano. Yes, he liked to write movie reviews. He was very good under the name Mr. First Nighter. So you say, yes, it's certainly possible to enjoy both the movie and the review as long as you don't find the review off-key or the movie off-key. Did he enjoy the James Bond movies? I think he did. I don't recall that he said much about them. Of course, I think Ayn Rand liked them. But I think he did. I think that, of course, there was a real James Bond, I think, in America with some sort of, I think he was some sort of scientist. Did he ever read Robert Heinlein? Well, I don't know, but he generally didn't like science fiction very much. He used to make fun of certain libertarians for being anybody called modal libertarians who were too were very interested in science fiction and futurism, and he wasn't. That really wasn't the way he did things. Well, I think by modal he just meant kind of ones who were kind of standard, kind of an average for the Libertarian Party at that time, like the, you know, like the mode, you know, the mean, median, and mode, kind of the most common type. Did he ever write about the New Atheists? No, he didn't really. I mean, I think, of course, Dawkins' book on his evolutionary stuff had come out while Rothbard was still alive, but I don't think he ever was aware of another one. Did he meet or know Robert Welsh? I don't know if he met personally. I think he liked Robert Welsh, and there are certainly people who knew both of them, were friendly with both of them. But there was of course the Robert Welsh very much liked Mises, and Mises was on the editorial advisory board of American Opinion, which was the magazine that the Welsh put out. I remember I once asked Revelo Oliver, who was one of the classics professors, what he thought of Rothbard. He said he disagreed. He thought some of Rothbard's stuff was brilliant, but he disagreed with some of what he said. How would you say the Austrian school has changed or branched since Rothbard? Well, I think, you know, at the meetings we've tried to continue what Rothbard was doing. You know, there are other groups. Yes, Oliver did go off a deep end. Yes, he was very very unusual person. You know, I'm used to getting known, but he's not the most unusual person I ever met, but he was up there, even stranger than I am, and that's saying a lot. Oh yeah, yes, he was funny. Someone said, yes, Rothbard did like H.L. Mencken. He was one of his favorite writers, a great humorist. Was there a book that changed his life? I don't know if you could single out a single book. Maybe Human Action had the biggest influence on him. It's at least certainly in economics, but... Well, I guess we're out of time, so I hope we'll see you all next week. So thanks very much for coming to the lecture. So see you again. Now the next lecture might be a bit more boring because I won't be giving as many anecdotes, but we'll try to throw in a few. Okay, thanks everybody. See you next week.